Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. State legislators are in Frankfort trying to make the numbers add up in a multi-billion-dollar two-year state budget, and looming over the whole process are public pensions that have, over the last decade, plunged into the red by many billions. If you're not familiar with or just want to refresh yourself on why and how this happened, I recommend watching the Frontline program, The Pension Gamble. You'll find a link to that on our site, esweku.org. We're going to hear from a few among the many making compelling arguments for additional funding. Later in the hour, we'll talk with one of Kentucky's top budget analysts about the big question, how are we going to pay for it all? Joining us now is Dr. Terry Brooks, Executive Director of Kentucky Youth Advocates, and as the organization's title implies, they're all about being a voice on behalf of Kentucky kids as our legislators formulate policies and allocate very scarce funding that will affect those children. Welcome, Dr. Brooks.
Tom, we always appreciate when you focus on kids and families.
In your recently released document, Blueprint for Kentucky's Children, you cite policy and state budget priorities for 2020. What items are at the top of your list?
We know that a state budget really is a reflection of priorities and principles just as much as it's a reflection of dollars and cents. So when we look at our budget-based request for kids in Kentucky, we do try to keep in mind that we're a state with scarce resources and apparently facing even more scarce resources. So we try to approach this in a very realistic way. We do not ask for the sky. When we look at what we think is a reasonable and pragmatic approach to the 2020 budget, we have three or four items that sort of jump to the top of the list. Number one is that we all know that last year the General Assembly tackled the tough issue of school safety in just an amazing way. Senate Bill 1, which passed last year, both chambers just flew through it by consensus, was a thoughtful piece of legislation. It really does move us to the day where every kid is safe in every school in Kentucky. But we've got to put dollars behind that. The good news is that the Bevin administration, and for this they merit credit, and I'm sure that Governor Beshear will continue this, we're pulling down unprecedented federal Medicaid money on a match. What that means is that a local superintendent can spend a dollar and get $3 from the feds on mental and behavioral health services, school nurses, those kind of really important protections for kids in schools. In order for our commitment to school safety to be a reality and not just rhetoric, we've got to undergird that with dollars. That same premise applies to child welfare. There's no arena in the last three or four years that the General Assembly has tackled with more vigor and, frankly, with more bipartisan passion than child welfare. I think they have looked at it in creative and thoughtful ways. Again, now that we have the focus on child welfare, Kentucky's most vulnerable children, we've got to put real dollars behind those efforts. And while child welfare touches so many arenas, abuse and neglect, out-of-home care, family preservation, I'll hold up one element of that continuum and talk about, as an example, what it needs from a budget perspective, and that's kinship care. Kentucky leads the nation in the percentage of children in kinship care, over 100,000 kids. Kinship care is an arrangement where when a little boy or a little girl can't stay with mom and dad, a relative or we use the phrase fictive kin. It's a terrible label, but think godparents. Mm-hmm. So an aunt, an uncle, a godmother, a grandma, they take care of the kid instead of that child being placed in out-of-home care. We know that for the little boy or little girl, in almost every case, That's the next best arrangement. We also know from a very pragmatic basis that it's a real dollar saver for the state. It costs a whole lot less for that kid to be in kinship care than in out-of-home care. However, since kinship is a relatively new element that's being recognized, I think it's been historic for a long time, but now it's really a formal part of the child welfare system, we need some additional dollars, and I'll give you three examples. First of all, the stipend that a kinship provider gets is significantly less than a foster parent, even though the function's the same. So if I'm a grandma and I need diapers or food, you know, I'm not getting a discount at the grocery. So I need a higher monthly standard to support that kid. Number two, currently foster parents get 24 hours of what we call respite care, which means somebody comes in and watches those children while you go to the doctor or go to the grocery or maybe just get a cup of coffee. Kinship families don't get any formalized respite care, and they need it. I've told you before, I have 8 grandkids, and I love them to death, but man, when they all are at our house on Sunday, I got to go back to work Monday to rest. So we need for kinship families, when it comes to respite care, to be afforded the same opportunity that foster families do. The third budget element, and again, I don't want to get in the weeds, but I want to use this as an illustration, is that generally speaking, kinship happens in a crisis. I mean, a mom or a dad gets incarcerated. There maybe is an addiction overdose. There's other kind of complicating factors. And grandparents literally find those children on their steps. Well, you know, when you're not expecting it, you may not have that crib, that supply of diapers, the clothing that you need. And one of the other things that we hear from kinship providers that they have a desperate need for is a more robust allocation for what I would call startup. So a one-time allocation when you take those children into your home, we know you've got to make that initial investment. So again, I have not talked to a single legislator, and Governor Beshear during the campaign was very articulate in supporting kinship care. That kind of support is wonderful as long as it's undergirded with dollars and cents. And so that's the second priority is the entire spectrum of child welfare. I use kinship just as an example. A third area that I know is especially pertinent in Eastern Kentucky is to ensure that child care supports are strengthened, that parents have access to affordable, high-quality child care. Again, what we know, given our budget situation, we're big on ideas that produce a return on investment. There is no better example of that than if we front-load support for child care. That is going to allow so many more folks to enter the workforce and become productive players within local economy. Following that notion of return on investment is a fourth, and that is that we come back again pressing the idea of a state refundable earned income tax credit. If there is an example of a return on investment, it's a state EITC. We know that with a refund that a family gets, it simply helps them make ends meet. They're going to spend that money to repair their car, to buy a new appliance, to get kids ready for the school year. They're going to spend it locally, which produces more money in the local economy, which actually turns out to produce more state budget money. So all of these ideas produce good return on investment. Kinship care, for instance, a much less expensive and higher quality alternative than out-of-home care. We wind up saving money by spending money.
Dr. Terry Brooks, he is Executive Director of Kentucky Youth Advocates. Thanks so much, Terry.
Tom, thanks always for highlighting kids.
Now let's bring in Kentucky Chamber President and CEO Ashley Watts for a look at the budget priorities of the Kentucky Business Education Roundtable. The roundtable, convened by the Chamber, is a group of public and private sector leaders who work on a long-term plan to improve the state's education attainment and workforce quality. Thanks for coming in, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
And let's jump right into it. Let's look at the roundtable's legislative priorities for the 2020 session.
Great.
If you had to pick out the top three on the top of your mind, what are they?
I think it's really education funding. So the Business Education Roundtable is made up of the top business leaders from each sector in Kentucky and the top education leaders. And really, we've been working over the last couple of years to make a transformational change in education, one that will make a long-term, sustainable change in education. And what we have realized is that even over the last 10 years, education funding has dropped. So one of the top priorities, I think, would be restoring higher education funding. I think it would shock some people to know that higher education was funded at a higher level 10 years ago than it is now. And surely we can do better when we're talking about getting an attainable degree. We've also have a very high focus on quality childcare, preschool, and making sure that every child has that opportunity to go to preschool here in Kentucky, and making sure that there is fully funded all-day kindergarten in Kentucky, and making sure that all students also have access to quality childcare and preschool. You know, we know now that those 3, 4, 5 years of life are so transformative to someone, and that your brain's actually working much faster and growing faster than it ever will in the rest of your life. And if they don't have that good foundation of quality preschool, then really we're not setting them up the best that we can. I have been doing quite a bit of studying on this issue, and it's fascinating to find out that if you invest in early child care and early preschool for all students, then 10, 20 years down the road, Medicaid numbers drop, incarceration rates drop, because really, preschool is one of the best foundations that we can give our students and our future workforce.
Many of the counties and the communities in our broadcast area, which is largely central and eastern Kentucky, are really struggling. Mm-hmm. There has been an out-migration of population and other, of course, the decline of the coal industry, the decline of coal severance taxes. All of that feeds into a weakened economy in the region. And that leads to less support for public education. Mm-hmm. Yet, as the Chamber argues, and just about everybody argues, education is the answer to that.
It is.
Do you agree that we have to find some way to connect those two dots, even though we've got this ginormous deficit on our hands? We're never going to get out of it until we can figure it out.
It really is the key to prosperity, and you're exactly right. When we keep dwindling away at education funding, I mean, we're going to keep digging ourselves deeper and deeper into this hole, and kind of these problems that we've seen across Kentucky for decades and over cycles really will just keep continuing. And so I often think that we have to switch the way that we do the budget. Instead of being so reactionary and kind of patching things together and patching up holes or fixing problems, we need to try to take a proactive stance and lay a good foundation, give people opportunities in education, because we know that those are investments. That's hard to do, obviously. You know, the economy overall in Kentucky as a state is doing fairly well. We have, you know, record low unemployment, record number of job investments. We have more open jobs and we have people looking. But there are still some parts of the state, like in eastern Kentucky, that have had outward migration, job loss, and we really need to make sure that we're still, you know, focusing on those areas, educating them, giving them the tools they need. We've seen most of the major growth since the recession in the metropolitan areas, and that's really kind of a national trend. But overall, Kentucky is a rural state, so we need to make sure that we're balancing the needs of both the urban and the rural.
There is this massive, growing 900-pound mm-hmm. gorilla lumbering around the Capitol these days, and that's a continuing public pension crisis and a projected budget shortfall that could exceed $1 billion if the numbers are right. So I'm wondering how, in light of all this reading, can anything other than the most essential basic services be adequately funded?
It is definitely going to be a struggle. And sometimes I think it's interesting for people to hear because overall the economy is good. And so if the economy is good, then how can the budget be that bad? And it's because we have some unsustainable programs that are just spending much more money at a much faster rate than the overall state budget. So 10 years ago, the Kentucky Chamber published a report called The Leaky Bucket. And basically we said that if the budget was a bucket, it had three major holes in this bucket, things that were outspending at a pace faster than the state budget. And those holes were pensions, corrections, and Medicaid. 10 years later, we've just done kind of an update on the leaky bucket, a checkup, if you will, and there are still three major holes: pensions, corrections, and Medicaid. And while those things are just spiraling out of control cost-wise, we don't have enough money being brought into the budget. So it's going to be a very daunting task this session for the governor and the legislature to craft a budget that focuses on education, that fully funds the pension system, that increases education funding, if they don't bring in new revenue. So there are some revenue measures that I think could be considered this year. I don't know if they will bring in kind of the big dollar numbers that are needed to patch things together, but I do think it's an opportunity for the legislature and for the governor to start looking at some revenue enhancers for the budget, because right now, like you said, it's going to be a bare minimum, and I don't really see a way out of it while we could keep continually fully funding the things that we think are priorities.
To generate those revenues, do we need to get more serious about tax modernization and reform, and in particular look at spreading the coverage of the service sector?
You know, we do think there needs to be additional tax reform. There was tax reform done 2 years ago and then a cleanup bill this past session that did slowly move us toward what we would say more of a consumption-based tax system, where you lower the income rate, lower the corporate tax, and spread the sales tax out to some services. We really are a service-based economy these days, much more than we were when our tax system was created. So we do need to modernize it. And, you know, there are ways to modernize and update a tax system to really make us more competitive and raise much needed revenue. States like North Carolina have done it. And so the chamber over the last couple of years, the business community has really taken a pretty pragmatic approach and has shifted our thoughts on tax reform to where we now make a very bold call to say we do need tax reform and it does need to increase revenue.
From your perspective, from a business perspective, how would you prescribe state and private sector collaboration working together? How can the state and private sector work together to create the dynamic economy that we need and want?
I think the best thing that we can do is making sure that the employer community is at the table when it comes to education and workforce. So, you know, we rely quite a bit on our educational system to teach our students everything they need to know. But we really, as the business community, need to have a seat at the table, and we need to make sure, you know, that we are part of the solution, that we are working with the community colleges and the universities and the high schools to make sure that they're training and teaching students for the jobs that we as employers will need. How can they know if we do not tell them? It really is more of a pipeline that we're building to really build the workforce for tomorrow, to have employers work together, collaborate with the education community to ensure that every student has a marketable, attainable degree, and they will be able to get employment once it's done.
Kentucky Chamber President and CEO Ashley Watts. Thanks so much, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up after the break.
We're a high poverty state, no doubt. But the only way I see us getting out of poverty is, in fact, investing in the solution to make that happen, and that's higher education.
For many, many years, we haven't really focused very much on the revenues, and so we end up in situations like we hear about in today's world with not enough money to do the things that people would like to do.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We're crunching numbers in this edition of Eastern Standard as the state legislature attempts to work out a two-year state budget with fewer dollars coming in than going out. Here to give us the higher ed perspective on the budget is Dr. Aaron Thompson. He's president of the Kentucky Council on Post-Secondary Education. Greetings, Aaron.
Greetings, Tom. How are you?
I'm really good. However, I have to cite where we are after a decade of decline that results in a 21% cut in state spending on public colleges and universities in our state. They're among the deepest cuts in the whole country. Kentucky has been ranked eighth worst among states for college affordability. That's measured as the average net price of higher education at a public four-year institution as a share of median household income. Some say cuts to higher education don't save money. They just shift costs over to students. So as legislators cut funding, are they in fact really raising the cost of going to college?
The short answer is yes. In many ways, there's multiple inputs on this, right, Tom? For an example, we have raised tuition over the last many years, even though we haven't raised nearly as much as the state cuts have been. We've only replaced, if you will, about 60% of those cuts with tuition increases. As a matter of fact, I'm proud to say my first year in this job, we only raised tuition about 2.2%, which was a little bit lower than inflation. But what you're doing is still over 11 years of budget cuts, fairly deep cuts, as you all know. We had to raise tuition. We've cut into our programs. We've cut deep into our wraparound services. So that tuition dollar really isn't serving nearly the value of a state dollar. And with that in mind, their families and students are having to pay more. And many are not only afraid they can't afford to go to college, many don't finish college because, in fact, they can't afford to finish. So it is, in fact, I think, a way of thinking about a lack of state funding as having a direct impact on the affordability.
Well, I would say if ever there was a time when we needed to search for the best way to get the best bang for the buck, it's right now because we have so few bucks. And your office recently came out with a return on investment report that shows that state spending for public higher education more than pays for itself. And the report looks at the return on investment for both the individual student and the state as a whole. So I'd like to separate them, if we could, and first look at the ROI for the individual student.
Thanks, Tom. And a couple of things I want to say. First of all, we know that higher education matters. We know it's important at many different levels for your health, for your civic engagement, but also for economic growth for you as an individual and for the state. We're a high poverty state, no doubt. But the only way I see us getting out of poverty is, in fact, investing in the solution to make that happen, and that's higher education. So we did this cohort study. We looked at every student that graduated from high school in 2010, which was somewhere around 42,800, and we looked at what happened to those students. If they went to college, if they didn't go to college, what were the outcomes of those students? So of the students that went to college, we had about 32% that didn't go to college. But of all the students that did go to college, some didn't finish. But those that finished, we looked at what is the return on investment for that student based on what they put into it. So as an example, if you were getting a certificate, usually about 1 year of your time or opportunity cost, you would have invested somewhere around $17,201 in that cohort. What came out of that was earning about, over a lifetime, about $1.2 million. So the return on investment was huge for a certificate. Look at an associate degree, to get that associate degree anywhere between 2 and 3 years, you would have invested somewhere around $35,000. But the return on investment for a lifetime is $1.4 million. If you invested about $84,000 for your total college cost, I'm not just talking about tuition. I'm talking about living. I'm talking about all kinds of other inputs it takes to go to college. Over a lifetime, you would have gotten a return on investment of about $2.2 million. So this is what we found out, that if you, in fact, got a college degree of any sort, you're putting about $1.7 million into the economy, which is about 40 times the return on investment.
So that would seem to bring us right around to what's in it for the state. What's the bang for the buck there?
You know, interesting, because we're a high-aid state, so there's a lot of money put into it. We obviously have direct appropriations through the performance funding model anyhow now to our campuses. So the state invested in a student to get that certificate about $48,297. And with that, they got about a $1.2 million return. If the state invested for an associate degree, which was about $40,780, they would have gotten a return on investment about $1.7 million. I'm sorry, that's for a bachelor's degree. The last was for an associate degree. If they got a graduate degree, the state invested about $51,000 and got a $2.1 million return. So looking at this, the state yields a significant output. In other words, they put about $630 million into the cohort of 2010 and is getting a yield significantly higher, about $42.8 billion in return, and which is about 68 times the investment. So what we see here is that there is a great return for the student, him or herself, if they get that credential. And there's a huge return on the state if that student stays in the state and adds to the economy.
So you have described your ask of the legislature on behalf of post-secondary education in Kentucky for the next biennium as no frills.
Yes, sir.
Tell us more about that.
You know, we decided, our finance committee and our board decided, along with our staff and myself and VP for finance and others, that we haven't been invested in a long time by the state, or at least there's been significant cuts, and we were only one of two states still in the process of cutting. So we had to get money somehow into the post-secondary system that goes directly to our campuses. So we decided that we weren't going to have a lot of parts to ask this time. So we basically only have two parts. One part is that of putting money into the performance funding model. And the second would be that we would ask for money for asset preservation. In other words, we have buildings on our campuses that are crumbling, needs roof. Many need just basically plumbing infrastructure. So we're asking the state to support that. So that's our two ask, which is, in fact, one of the smallest set of variables we've used in the past for a budget ask. And what we are asking for, I will tell you, is that for performance funding in the biennium, we're asking for the first year $52.5 million, and that would go to our 8 universities and 16 community colleges. And we're asking for $75 million in the second year of that biennium.
And for those who are not quite up to speed on it, what is performance funding?
Performance funding is that we have at the council a mechanism for distributing all of the dollars that go to our university through a performance funding pool. In other words, some of the main variables we use are outcomes that we feel that are important to the state. How many students that we graduate, how many students that get certain sorts of degrees and credentials, how many students stay on time to get that degree or credential, because that's important. That's obviously an efficiency as well as an effectiveness measure. But we also want to make sure that our students that are in the most need get priority to help them to get through, such as our low-income first-generation students in many cases and our students of color. But we also need STEM degrees, more STEM degrees. So we have a bump for those that give STEM degrees. So the money that we actually push through the performance funding model that is, in fact, an efficiency measure and effectiveness measure for the state to ensure that the dollars are well spent. Now, the legislature actually put a group together that formed this model. And so it's CPE that have to implement that model. So any dollars that we ask for this time, we ask for it to go in here. And let me be clear. We're the only state that actually put together a performance funding model that didn't get new funds to put in it. We've used existing funds by actually distributing dollars from each of our campuses into a pot that was then distributed to the campuses that perform the most. And so we're at the, so my argument is the best way to make performance funding work is to put funding in that formula.
And performance funding is kind of in its infancy. Has there been time enough yet to take a measure of how effective it's being?
You know, there has been. You know, maybe not as deep as I would like as a methodologist, but there has been. We see behaviors that are changing that really are focusing our campuses on helping our students get through more. I mean, we see a lot of scholarships around helping our students get 15 hours a semester to get through. Our campuses are using more of their institutional dollars for need-based aid, as well as for those wraparound services to help our students get through faster. And we're also doing heavy recruiting on people of color, as an example, low-income students, and giving them what they need to get through. But yes, we are seeing behaviors of our campuses that are focusing on what we've asked them to focus on. You know, of all the degrees we've given in the last degrees and credentials in the last 5 years, 75% of those have been STEM-related. So we have, in fact, looked at ways that we can help. Now, I worry that some of our campuses aren't getting new money. So what does that mean? How can they sometimes perform at an equitable level if they don't have new funds to build those infrastructures that I just mentioned that are so crucial to the success of our students? But we have seen behavioral patterns that have changed, and we think those are very positive.
You're calling on the governor and the General Assembly to take action to maintain a stop-loss provision in fiscal 2021 and 22. What is this?
A stop-loss provision is this, that of all the money that are in that pool, that no campus can lose at any given time 2% of their budget. With that, that's a stop-loss. Now, the important piece to note there is that we have taken money from existing budgets to make this performance funding model go into effect, which means that in that case, truly, no campus is losing 2% of their already baseline. So the second year of the biennium, this upcoming year, the stop loss by legislation goes off. So it's then basically 100% can be lost, if you will. And so in this argument, we would like to ask the legislature to ensure that that stop loss stays in place that second year of the biennium.
Well, Dr. Thompson, here we are once again counting every single nickel and dime just to try to make ends meet. How much longer can this go on, and what are your concerns about the consequences of failing to adequately fund education in Kentucky?
Yeah, you know, good question. I'm going to combine those a little bit. What I know is we can limp along for a while. That doesn't make us effective. That doesn't make us do the things that we need to do to add to the economy of the state. That doesn't make us do the things we need to do to add to the workforce that builds that economy. So my argument is we could limp along, and we could probably limp along more for a little while, but that doesn't mean that we're going to be using us as a solution to many of the ills that we have in this state. So my argument simply is this, that this is about understanding what really is important to our state. It is about finding those dollars, and I understand a very demanding area with our budget. We've got pensions we have to deal with. We've got Medicaid. We've got the criminal justice system. We got all of those. And believe me, I respect and understand those. And so we do have to fulfill our obligations with the budget. But we also need to find some money to help fund this solution. So how much longer can we go? Well, once again, we can probably go a little bit longer, but you're still not going to get the effect that you really want us to have. So we have already in place the process, the infrastructures. We have the know-how. We have the knowledge. Our argument is, so help us to do the best we can do with all of those to get what you need.
Dr. Aaron Thompson, he's president of the Kentucky Council on Post-Secondary Education. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom, very much.
Earlier in the hour, we heard of some among the many needs presented to the Kentucky legislature now in the process of working out a state budget for the next two fiscal years, or biennium. Lots of demand for expenditures of state money to pay for such critical programs and services as education, human services, health care, and we haven't touched on Kentucky's incarceration rate, which is sky high and increasing, even as prison populations are steadily declining across most of the country. We have the nation's highest rates of cancer and other maladies. The past decade has seen cuts in state spending on public colleges and universities that are among the deepest in the entire country. Addressing these and many other pressing needs costs money, but Kentucky's budget by law must be balanced, and that means the state cannot spend more than it takes in each year. The question is, do we as a state generate enough money to pay for the essentials, not to mention investment in the future? And if not, why not? Pam Thomas is senior fellow at the nonprofit, nonpartisan Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. And prior to KCEP, Pam was staff administrator for the Appropriations and Revenue Committee of the Kentucky General Assembly. She has extensive experience in the areas of tax policy, budgeting, education finance, and workforce policy. And that's why we invited her to join us today. Thanks for coming in, Pam.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, we could fill hours talking about all the facets of the state budget, but in the end, doesn't it really all boil down to revenues lining up with spending?
Yes, it does. And for many, many years, we haven't really focused very much on the revenues, and so we end up in situations like we hear about in today's world with not enough money to do the things that people would like to do.
And of course, everybody knows there's a 900-pound gorilla in the room, the pension. We'll talk about that in just a second. But first, in just general terms, what are the options that are available for bringing revenues in line with spending?
Well, there are two questions there in your question, really. One is, do we bring revenues in line with spending, which means we need to increase revenues, or do we decrease spending in order to match the revenues that we have? And over the past several years, both kinds of things have happened, but the way that we've come up with revenues have been through things that a lot of folks would refer to as smoke and mirrors, or transferring funds from one-time sources into the budget, and they aren't recurring year after year. And that's called a structural deficit. It's when you spend more than you actually have. And Kentucky's done that for a lot of years. And so we're not in really good shape because a lot of our revenues have come from one-time sources, and our tax code has not been changed to generate the revenues that we need.
So on the matter of the pension, the Herald Leader's John Cheves has reported that Governor Beshear's proposed budget would mean tens of millions of dollars less than expected for Kentucky retirement systems each year during the next two fiscal years. The state pension system already has about a $14.2 billion unfunded liability. What is the impact of this shortfall on our regional universities, on quasi-government agencies such as health departments and rape crisis centers, those kinds of places?
What I can say about this is it's a much more complicated discussion than we can have in the amount of time that we have here. But the governor did propose additional funding to help the regional universities and the quasi-governmental agencies meet their pension obligations in his budget. The governor did propose fully funding the ARC for state employees and fully funding the ARC for teachers, along with health insurance for teachers. And so the outstanding issue is those quasi-governmental entities and universities. And over the years, they have paid in the system, and the system has been underfunded. And one of the reasons the system has been underfunded is for the reasons that I talked about just a minute ago. It was a place to get resources from that didn't require raising taxes. But in the pension system, when you do that, it's almost like a double whammy, because if you don't put in the money, then you don't get the investments, and then those comes back and hit you, and then we had a recession. So the pension system is very underfunded, but it is making progress. Last year, there was a lot, last biennium, there was a lot more money put in, and progress is being made. It's not fast progress, but you know, the devolution of the system wasn't all that fast either. So it's going to take a while for us to get back, but progress is being made.
And I should interject here that as we're talking about this, the situation's kind of fluid because there is some confusion over the numbers.
That's true. The governor came out with a proposal in his budget, and since then there have been some legislative testimony and some other comments. And so it isn't really clear what exactly the proposal from the governor is now. And what is known is that the General Assembly is going to come up with their own ideas. So I would stay tuned over the next month or so, because this will be a moving target and there will be a lot of discussion.
So we've heard from some of the many constituents out there that are looking to the state legislature to come up with more funding for their particular areas of interest. But can we talk about additional spending and investment when we have this woefully unfunded liability on our hands?
I think that we have to. The thing that we really do have to talk about is revenues and having resources to meet all of these obligations. There is no question that we have this large pension obligation hanging over our heads. The question we really need to answer is, are we going to cut and starve other government services to match that, or are we going to look for other ways to raise revenue so that we can both address the pension issue and make those whole and fund our schools and fund our roads and fund our health departments and do the other things that people expect from government?
Sports wagering is being touted as one untapped source of revenue for the state. It is legal in Indiana, West Virginia, Illinois, Tennessee, likely legal in Ohio by the end of the year. Could sports wagering make a significant dent in our revenue shortfall?
The answer, the short answer to that is probably not. And the reason why is that sports wagering has a very low margin. The market is saturated already, even though there are a fairly low number of states that do it. People can do it from anywhere and bet in those states. I think it would be a relatively small amount of revenue, maybe $10, $15 million. And it won't really grow over time. That's not a market that generally grows. And if you look at states that have had it for a long time, most notably Nevada, it's a very, very small portion of their overall gaming revenue, and it doesn't really grow. So it's a good thing, I think, to regulate it and tax it in Kentucky. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but we also shouldn't rely on it as a reasonable revenue source going forward that's going to help us a whole lot.
Okay. That word, which is glowingly radioactive, comes up now, and that is taxes as a source of revenues. How do Kentucky tax rates compare with those of the states around us?
I really don't like the question about comparison with states around us, and there's a reason why. It's very one-dimensional, and when people do compare that, they typically just look at tax rates. The other things you also need to look at is, how do the states around us invest in the things that we think are important? Are they investing at the same level as Kentucky is? And what different entities do they tax? And an example that I'll give you is, we are often compared to Tennessee, or we've heard people say we want to be more like Tennessee. And the reason why is that they don't have an income tax, but they have a very high sales tax, and they allow local sales taxes, but they also invest significantly less in education than we do in Kentucky, which might surprise a lot of people. The other thing about Tennessee is, their second biggest source of revenue is taxing businesses. And in Kentucky, the sort of way that we've thought about it, or that those that are currently elected have thought about it before, is that we should reduce the taxes as much as possible on businesses, and then we should shift taxes to the individual. And in a long-term sense, that's not a great strategy, because it's the income taxes that grow with the economy, and the sales taxes or consumption taxes really just don't.
So tax breaks, tax incentives, things like the repeal of the bank franchise tax, a tax cut for heavy equipment leasing companies, or an inventory tax credit for corporations. How have these tax breaks affected revenue growth?
What they do is that they reduce revenue growth in the future, because you're creating segments of our population that used to pay taxes that aren't anymore, or that paid at a certain rate or on certain things that aren't anymore. And of course, the theory behind that is the trickle-down theory, which is that if you don't tax the job providers, that they will invest more in our Commonwealth, create jobs, and we will get more tax revenue. And those were, we had tax changes in the 2018 and 2019 legislative session that reduced our income taxes, the top rate. And what we have seen since then is our revenue projections for the upcoming biennium, how much money we're going to take in as a state from our taxes, are the lowest that we've seen since they started doing the process, which was in 1996. So essentially, those cuts are not producing the revenues that folks thought that they would. And instead, it's showing that when you cut the taxes on those folks, we don't see the added investment.
Quite often, these tax incentives are provided in a transactional way. We get something back. In other words, job creation, a promise of job creation. What if a business that has received a tax incentive doesn't follow through on that promise?
Well, those in most economic development programs, the ability to change the incentives are called clawbacks. You can take back some of the money that you've given. And Kentucky is very, very weak in that regard. But we also don't have very high job creation numbers to begin with in Kentucky, nor do we have very high wage standards in our programs. And so, generally speaking, you don't see clawbacks when industry doesn't come through. Instead, they amend the agreements.
Okay, to talk about tax brackets, which you touched on just a second ago, your organization has produced a chart illustrating how the tax law passed by the General Assembly in 2018 cut taxes for people with incomes in the top 5%, but raised them on average for everyone else. Is that sustainable?
It's not sustainable over the long term, and there's a couple of reasons why. One is that all of the growth in our economy is essentially happening in that top 5%. So when you see people saying that the economy is growing and the economy is booming and that everything is going great guns, that's not happening for a majority of the people in the world. It's not happening for people in the middle income groups, and it's not. And in fact, those folks have seen erosion of the amount of money they take home when you consider inflation. So all the growth is there. So when you cut the taxes on the people who are benefiting the most, it stands to reason then that your revenues in the out years are not going to be as high as they otherwise would be. So we are hurting ourselves in the future by making changes like that now.
Why, Pam, do you think it's so hard to work out a modern, equitable system of taxation that moves Kentucky forward?
You know, I've thought about that a lot. And it seems logical that it is something that our elected leaders should be able to figure out and make happen. But I think that we haven't seen a lot of leadership on what I would call a positive tax message. And that is that we need revenues in order to make investments that we all want and need to make the Commonwealth what we want it to be. And so, you know, leading with the investment side of it, and that we can't do the investments without the revenues, would seem to be a strong way then to talk to people about that. But I think that we're starting to hear some of that now, and I think in part that's because things have gotten pretty bad with what people are expecting from government and what government can provide. I have hope that we can get there, you know, that we will see the message become more positive, and that constituents will tell their elected officials, we want to pay more taxes because we want these things that will help the economy grow, that will help our kids have strong schools, that will help us have roads paved, that will help us have health departments. But I think that's what it will take.
We're in a time right now of heightened distrust or mistrust of government. What do you say to the perception that government just wastes money, so why should we be open to new or higher taxes?
We have some really positive examples here in Kentucky when there were tax increases and good things happened, and the preeminent one that I can bring up is CARA. That was in the early 90s, and the General Assembly raised $1 billion in taxes, and because of the investments that they made in schools, Kentucky moved from the very bottom several places up, so that we were even looked at as a model with regard to what we did in education. And so I think that our elected leaders have shown in the past that if you give them the ability, they will invest safely and strongly in Kentucky and move us all forward.
We hear so often that many believe the economy is really doing well, as you just mentioned a minute ago. Low unemployment rates, many job openings going unfilled. How does Kentucky's job growth compare with the rest of the country?
Interestingly, our unemployment rate is at a historically low level, but it has stalled out over the past couple of years. While in the South and in the United States, the unemployment rate has continued to drop. The other thing that we see in Kentucky is that the recovery in unemployment rate is very uneven throughout the state. Generally speaking, in the urban areas, the unemployment rate is pretty low, but in the rural areas, we still have some areas with double-digit unemployment rates. And so to look at the state as a whole doesn't really tell the whole story. So even though we do have some areas in the state that have job-seeking people, we've got even more areas in the state where people would really like to work, but there are no jobs.
So as mentioned in the beginning, the state budget must be balanced. It's the law. So what in the end does that mean?
What that means is that either there will be some new revenue sources identified and the General Assembly will enact legislation that raises revenue, or there will be cuts.
It's that simple, isn't it?
It is that simple.
Pam Thomas is Senior Fellow at the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. Thanks, Pam.
Thank you.
We hope you'll join us next week when we feature another of our monthly series celebrating the centennial of ratification of the 19th Amendment establishing the right of women to vote. Guest interviewer Jackie Jay, a professor of ancient history at EKU, with Dr. Josh Lynn, assistant professor of history, EKU, on evolving understandings of citizenship and democracy in the early American Republic, which continue to evolve today. We'll have the results of a worldwide survey by the Lexington-based global animal nutrition company Alltech on women in food and agriculture.
I think this was probably as important for the men in the audience as the women. There's about a 20% difference in almost all of the categories in terms of what men felt and what women felt.
We'll be joined by Alltech President and CEO Mark Lyons to learn more about what is revealed in this extensive global survey. We have details of the second annual Kentucky Local Food System Summit at the University of Kentucky.
Folks who come to the summit can hear about farmers market innovations, so like the Kentucky Double Dollars program, Fresh RX for Moms program, the emergence of community cafes, all the way to value-added meat processing and produce processing. So there's going to be a really wide variety of topics addressed at the summit.
And we'll hear all about the film documenting Appalachia: Recovery, Resilience, Renewal. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We do like to hear from you. Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.